Welcome to another episode of the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Docheel, and today my guest is Ben Golliver from SportsIllustrated.com and the Open Floor Podcast. We talk about the NBA Finals. We talk about whether we're going to be seeing the Cleveland Cavaliers and Golden State Warriors in the Finals for the next few years. We also talk about what teams need to do or what changes can be made to get a different Finals outcome. So, you ready to tip it off? Ben, how you doing?
I'm good, Mo. How's it going, man?
Going well, man. Going well. Enjoying the nice Memorial Day weekend. I got lucky to get you on the pod. I'm super excited and ready to talk hoops.
Yeah, me too. You said you were in LA, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're the only two guys inside this weekend talking about basketball on a Sunday afternoon. So that shows that we're probably the two degenerates in the city, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We have issues. I'm having withdrawals with basketball not on TV right now. Like, I'm ready to, like, can we get the D-League going or something? Can I just start? I need my fix.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I was watching LaMelo Ball highlights today, so that's how low my life got.
Weren't they low lights? Weren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Tough go on the internet for that kid when your father's LeVar. Anything you do, good or bad, is going to get highlighted.
Yeah, I mean, it's an uphill battle for those other two, but I think Lonzo's in a good position. But we'll see if the rest of them can kind of, you know, get through the system with the same success. You never know.
Yeah, you never do. But I'm not a huge LeVar guy. I don't want to get into it all that much. So I'd rather talk about the finals. Since the finals are finally here, you know, we still have a few more days. But what are you watching for in the series with Golden State and Cleveland?
It's a great question. I mean, I think I always start with just how do teams defend LeBron James, and then how much success does he have against them? And I think what we saw during the Eastern Conference playoffs, or at least for most of it, was that his ability to get to the rim just put too much pressure on the opposing defenses. They never really solved him. Maybe as that Celtics series kind of unfolded a little bit, they had a little bit more success. But I mean, that's kind of rule one when you're, you know, diagramming a series with LeBron is, can you protect the basket? Can you consistently keep him out of the paint, or at least make it difficult for him? Or is it just, you know, he's you know, putting tons of pressure on the rim and then kicking out to his shooters? So I mean, that's number one. I mean, they have a lot of different ways they can go defensively. I mean, obviously Kevin Durant's there. That's very helpful compared to last year. You've got Klay that you could throw on him. You've got Draymond who, you know, in certain situations or, you know, even for long stretches, can be kind of a physical option on LeBron. Of course, Iguodala is going to be, you know, a huge X factor in this series, like he kind of always is against Cleveland. So that's a lot of personnel options. And of course, they also have, you know, their big lineups. And I think that's the second thing I'm really looking here is how much does Golden State play big versus how much does it go small? We've seen both lineups look very effective throughout the postseason, whether it's Zaza or whether it's even JaVale McGee having some real shining star moments as just kind of a simple finisher on offense at times during this postseason. How much do they want to work those guys in, or do they decide, look, we're way better just trying to get as many shooters on the court, spread things out, and allow Draymond to be the kind of the chief rim protector? Kind of how do they balance those two things is another thing that I'm looking at. The final thing I would say is just healthy Steph versus whatever we saw last year. And I think one of the biggest question marks coming out of that final series, I mean, you can go right down the list of like Draymond suspension, Andre Iguodala gets injured, you know, Bogut kind of gets knocked out, all those terrible minutes they had from, you know, guys like Festus and Varejao late in that series. I mean, all of those things are moot points potentially if Steph just goes nuts in one of those games, 5, 6, or 7, right? Like, he never really had that showcase performance that we kind of expected late in that series. And we never got a clear answer whether that was health related or not. And so that's kind of the third thing that I'm looking for is just if it's healthy Steph, you know, if this guy is just kind of gunning on all cylinders, you don't really have an answer for him. How does Cleveland react? Or are they just kind of dead in the water? Or is that the series? You know, if he's looking healthy and really in a good groove. And I thought against the Spurs, Steph was spectacular in terms of getting his own shot and running the offense. You know, great at the end of game one and then kind of closing them out. I thought he was excellent in game four as well. So those are a couple of things I'm looking for. What are you looking for?
Yeah, I think you're right on with how you defend LeBron is something I'm really interested in, especially if he's like, this is the best he's ever shot in the playoffs from three. He's shooting 42.1% from three. And that's like,
that just makes him so much harder to guard. Everything, all the points you made about trying to keep him out of the paint and everything, and you want him normally to shoot, but if he's shooting like that, that makes it interesting. So I am really curious to see really the matchups and how everything goes. Like you said, they could throw so many different people at LeBron. I'm curious to see who does the best job of the Warriors, or if anybody really can do a good job on him. I think the Steph thing, I'm with you. I'm kind of curious if we're finally going to get to see, you know, Steph have a great finals. You know, last year, probably injuries, there was other stuff. The year before, he really wasn't that great. Some of it might have pointed to Dellavedova, but I think, you know, this might be the finals where we might see a great performance from Steph, and really in the biggest spotlight, which is something we haven't seen in the past two. I'm always interested in the coaches. Like, I want to see what they're running. I want to see what ATOs, after timeout plays, Tyronn Lue has, you know, to get his guys the shots, and who he's going to. You know, is he trying to set LeBron up, or is he trying to set Kyrie up, or get Love going? You know, for the Warriors, I'm very interested in seeing the lineups and how Mike Brown kind of plays with it and tinkers with it. You know, you touched on it. You know, do they go big and keep playing JaVale McGee and you know, Zaza and all those guys, or do they just say, screw it, we're going all five shooters and spreading the floor, and we're going to make it difficult for guys like Love and Thompson to stay on the court? So those are kind of the things I am watching for in the finals, and really excited to see how this plays out in that run of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the shooters is, and this is something I mentioned in my piece last week, and just in terms of like 23 things that you could look forward to or get excited about with the finals, one of them was the prospect of just both teams putting out five shooters, you know, and it can happen very easily. I mean, especially as you mentioned with LeBron shooting so well, I mean, all they really have to do is take Tristan out, have LeBron or Love playing the center position, and then you can just load up the rest of that lineup with really quality shooters, guys who have proven three-point percentages. And then same thing for Golden State. I mean, they can get five shooters on the court anytime Draymond's playing center, basically. So this kind of futuristic basketball where all 10 guys on the court are in downsized lineups and shooting could produce just some insane offensive fireworks. I'm a little nervous that could produce blowouts too, like one-sided games. We saw a lot of that last year during the finals. I'm a little worried we could see that again this year. You know, one team gets hot, one team gets grooving. Just the variance there in terms of like, you know, the peaks that teams can get to offensively is one thing that I'm kind of a little bit nervous about in this series, because I want this series to be great. You know, I mean, the third time here in 3 years. Classics last year, kind of a half classic in 2015, given how well LeBron played, kind of in a kind of a hero ball mode. But one thing you mentioned with his shooting himself, it started to taper a little bit, his outside shooting against Boston. I mean, he started out scorching hot against Indiana, scorching against Toronto. We've seen like Popovich in San Antonio, 2013, 2014, dare LeBron to shoot. And I almost wonder if we could see a little bit of that come back in this series, especially if he's really like, I expect him to come out just crazy in game one, because he's going to have a super long rest. We saw what he did in game one against Boston. If he's continuing to get guys like Draymond in foul trouble repeatedly, if he's trying to like punish Andre Iguodala physically, and these guys are struggling to kind of keep up, I could see Golden State actually go into that strategy where it's like, okay, we are going to dare you to shoot, because they're going to be nervous about the catch and shoot guys that surround him, and they're going to kind of pick their poison, and maybe at some point of this series say, all right, LeBron, you got to prove it with your three-pointer. I mean, he's done that during this postseason, and it definitely is a pick your poison thing. Like, he can beat you with his shot, there's no question about it. I do wonder, though, as the series unfolds, if we're going to see a little bit of that.
I think you kind of have to. I think you do have to pick your poison at one point. You know, you got to live with something. And him at the rim is probably the most damaging thing, right? I mean, we can agree to that. Every time he drives, it attracts so much attention. It opens the three balls up for everybody else, and dump offs to Thompson for a dunk, and just him alone with a rim-rattling dunk to kind of get things going. So I think you do have to pick your poison with him, especially if he's hot and gets going from three. You're right on him kind of trailing off a little bit in that Boston series. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. You mentioned this being the third time they're playing, you know, in a row. This is the first time we've had three finals in a row, you know, same finals in a row. Excuse me, it just seems hard to say even. Where does this rank in terms of rivalries?
Yeah, I think it's the best that I've seen since I've covered the league. I mean, the last 10 years has sort of been my kind of writing era. I mean, there is a richness to it just because it's sort of like LeBron's team. I mean, never really felt like it was LeBron's team in Miami. Obviously, it was. But there's a totally different feel last year, especially when that series ended, when he brings it home to Ohio. He gets all the kind of home state love. He ends their long curse. I mean, the unprecedented comeback. I mean, all those factors kind of coming together really elevated not only his position with that team, but I think the whole rivalry to a different level. In terms of, you know, all-time greatest rivalries, I mean, I was thinking about it this way. Like, Jordan beat so many Hall of Famers along the way, especially in the Eastern Conference. But, like, even in the finals, I mean, you just go right down the list. He got Magic. He got Drexler. He got Barkley. He got Peyton and Kemp, potentially, however they come down on Kemp. He got Malone and Stockton. But he never was in a situation where, like, any of his finals opponents were basically the second and third best player in the league, you know? And it might not be a consensus. I mean, you can make arguments for Kawhi. You could throw in Russ. You could throw in Harden, whatever. But generally speaking, over these last couple of years, I think most people would agree the top three players have been LeBron, Steph, and KD, at least when KD's been healthy. So I think from that standpoint, this is like the toughest challenge of LeBron's career. And I think you make a pretty strong argument it's a tougher challenge than any of the finals opponents that Jordan faced. So that right there alone is just like, if you have an all-time great player, a guy who's going to go down as one of the three best players, you know, at minimum, I think, in NBA history once he's done, facing his toughest test and having that test be the second and third best player in the league, I mean, to me, that also elevates this rivalry. So, I mean, maybe it's not quite Celtics-Lakers in terms of just the decades of history behind it, but I struggle to find a better rivalry from, like, the 90s. I mean, given the stakes. I mean, given how well Golden State's been, the 73-win team, the most wins over a three-year period, you know, I would put them above, like, Bulls-Knicks or whatever you would say the best rivalry from the 90s was on that side. In terms of the finals, like Bulls-Jazz, I mean, I don't think that has the same star power and wattage as Cavaliers and Warriors does. And then also, I just think the nature of that Game 7 last year really took it to a different level too, because, you know, this is a game where that Game 7 is now in the discussion with Game 6 of Spurs Heat as being like the best game of the last 10 years, right? And we didn't think there was ever going to be a game kind of challenging that one with Ray Allen's shot and the overtime and all that. So, I mean, these are just a lot of really thick layers to get through. So to me, I think I would probably say, you know, it's right up there. I mean, I would still kind of reserve Celtics-Lakers as being the kind of rivalry that extended over multiple decades as being sort of untouchable. But I'd be interested to hear, like, what you would think would be second behind that, because I think Cavaliers-Warriors is working its way into that conversation, and it could be there again next year, and it could be there again 2 years from now. I don't think this matchup is really going anywhere.
Yeah, I actually have it pretty much right behind just the Boston-Lakers kind of rivalry. Really, I mean, when you add in, forget the number of times they've matched up against each other, but you can tell there's definitely animosity between the teams. I mean, the whole LeBron Halloween party and the tombstones with the Curry's number, and you got to step over the dead warrior or whatever to get in, and all of that stuff. Like, kind of, it helps with social media to kind of kick it up a bit. You know, Draymond saying in interviews, you know, he wants to annihilate the Cavs this time around, and really kind of put his foot down. I mean, it's not quite Boston Lakers, just because you get, I'm never going to forget the time that Kurt Rambis got freaking clotheslined, you know, and it's just a regular foul in 80s basketball and super physical. And like you said, just the history goes so far back. I mean, the Draymond kind of like groin punch, if even that, you can even call it that, doesn't really kind of reflect, is like a mini version of what we saw with the Celtics-Lakers run. So I kind of think that they're shooting up. I think you brought on an interesting point, though, about Jordan, which kind of want to talk just a little bit about. It's sort of like in boxing how, like, a great heavyweight never really has a challenger. And it's true. Like, Jordan never really had a guy that was truly his rival at any point during that run. And I think that's kind of something, you know, LeBron has found that in the Warriors. You know, like, it's basically LeBron going up against the Monstars.
Yeah, well, it's funny because Jordan just kind of ended those rivalries as soon as possible. Like, I grew up in Portland, and so you go back and you read some of, like, the finals preview stuff from that final series, and, like, this was Drexler's chance to like show Michael who was boss, right? Like that's how they were pitching it. And like that narrative just died, you know, like six games later, that was done. You go back and you read about Barkley, you know, and Barkley like famously was telling people, you know, before that series, you know, he thought he was the best player in the world. He was going to show Mike. And then, you know, Mike comes out and scores 50 plus in that series. And Barkley goes home and says, well, I'm not the best player in the world anymore. You know, he just kind of had to take his lumps. And I think it's just such a tough comparison because we've also seen LeBron get smoked in the finals. Like, it's not just that LeBron has lost in the finals. We've seen him get worked. And, you know, that's where the team game aspect comes into it. I mean, you certainly can't really hold it against him like 2007. How much do you hold 2014 against him? I don't think that was his best series, but certainly he was the best player on his team in that series. You know, you go back to 2011, I was there for that. I mean, that was really kind of incomprehensible as it unfolded. I still don't know if he's completely explained that one to himself. So he's had these moments of like big time faltering where history is always going to remember that, not only as losses, but sort of like remembering his role in them. And I think there's, like I said, 2007 is not the same as 2011. It's not the same as 2014. I mean, they're all kind of on this range, but they all have to be considered. And that's why so many people, even like Allen Iverson recently, where he was saying, you know, nobody compares to Mike. I mean, it's the aura of invincibility that Jordan carries because of the 6-0 finals record, because, you know, he conveniently took a mini retirement after his first three-peat to kind of recharge the batteries. You know, he conveniently retires again after the second three-peat. So he was never quite pushing his body for as many years as LeBron has pushed his, never kind of making himself susceptible to losing in the finals like LeBron has. I mean, just year after year, you're going to have different situations where all your teammates get injured, like in 2015. I mean, what's really LeBron supposed to do about that? So I don't know. It's a fascinating debate. I do think that I was never really willing to even consider the conversation before last year's finals. Last year's finals, you know, it bothered me a lot less after LeBron pulled that finals off when people would compare him to Jordan, because it was like that was such a crowning achievement of his career. If he wins this finals, and my prediction is that he will not, but if he somehow wins this finals, it's going to be hard to keep him out of this conversation. I mean, this conversation is really going to get intense. I would suspect all summer long, this is going to be the kind of the leading topic of conversation besides free agency and the draft and so forth. I think you're going to see people dissecting that one from every single angle.
Yeah, it's a hard conversation. Generally, I don't like to do it just because totally different eras. You know, I think, you know, MJ was the best in his era, and God, you hit the nail head on when you're the invincibility of it, like when you're going up against MJ, you know, and if you were the guy that's supposed to take over, you know, he made sure you knew when you left that you're not taking over shit. Like, this is still his. And I think it's difficult in those times, and plus there's such different players in the style of play, and you know, LeBron kind of compares more to Magic to me than he does MJ in terms of how he plays and so on. And even just the not as much as, and I don't want to say he doesn't have a killer instinct, but just doesn't have that I'm going to kill you kind of like the way Jordan did, because Jordan did it in kind of like a psychopath kind of way, you know, and that was kind of similar to what Kobe emulated, and they just have that weird look where you're like, you're actually crazy, whereas like LeBron has a look of like he's gonna kill you, but he's smiling and everything's okay. So I think there's kind of that difference to me, but I generally try to stay away from the debate itself, because I think they're just both so great, and I think it trying to compare him to Jordan kind of makes us take away from LeBron's greatness in the sense of, you know, 07 when they go to the finals and get swept by the Spurs. Not that many people remember I forget what it was, like 29 straight points he put up against the Pistons to get there, you know, and with that shitty team that he had and how great the Pistons were at that time, especially defensively. Like, that's kind of the things where it's like we sort of forget that stuff because we're so busy trying to compare him to MJ. They're two separate people in two separate eras. I just think they're both great. But if I had to, I'd put him just behind MJ. I mean, he's number two to me based on what he did last year. And if he wins it this year, then you're right. Like, this kicks off a whole new angle for the debate.
Yeah, I guess my point is just like, I have always tried to sort of avoid this too, because I've always kind of taken like the MJ stan elitist perspective of like, look, nobody's on MJ's level. There's no more hiding for us. There's no more there's no more hiding for me. There's no more hiding for you. If LeBron wins this finals, this is going to be the topic of conversation. And, you know, one thing, you know, with LeBron moving past Jordan for career postseason points, you know, it's just a fascinating situation where you start to project out, you know, how high could he take that number? You know, I mean, LeBron has another 5, 6, 7 years in him. You know, my pet theory is that he wants to stay around until he can play with his son, right? Like kind of be like the Ken Griffey Jr. and senior of the NBA. I mean, if he really did that, it's insane to think about how high his, you know, counting stats in the postseason would get. And it's also crazy to think, I mean, he could finish all-time number one in scoring, number two in assists in NBA history, you know, and he could be potentially number one, I think, in both for the playoffs. And you know, he's going to wind up, you know, just by sheer volume, you know, potentially getting his rebounding number up there pretty high. I mean, he could easily be the number one non-center in terms of rebounding if he just, you know, continues along at his current pace and just keeps playing, you know, kind of Tim Duncan like until he's 40. I mean, when one guy is on that many all-time lists for the league, it gets tricky. And you know, we have kind of made, you know, not excuses for Jordan in terms of like, okay, well, he had a higher scoring average, he didn't play as many games as LeBron. But if LeBron sustains excellence for, you know, 18 years, that is now all of a sudden that works in his favor. That definitely works against Jordan. Like Jordan's aura of invincibility doesn't look quite as impenetrable if LeBron's doing it for almost twice as long.
No, that's a great point. I mean, the longevity of it and where he's going to end up in all those lists. And if he's number one all-time in scoring, number one all-time in assists, like...
Yeah, I think he'll probably wind up second in assists. I think Stockton is, like, untouchable, basically. Last time I looked at this, I got to double-check this. But I'm pretty sure, like, one for scoring and two for assists is in play for the regular season, which is, like, what everybody really cares about. But, I mean, think about the moment, and it's not that far away. I mean, he's going to pass Jordan regular season scoring in 2 years. Like, I mean, Kobe did that and he was like on a wheelchair, end of his career. And like, you know, it was a fascinating moment. Everybody, you know, freaked out about it, even though it was free throws and that kind of, you know, cheapened it a little bit. But like, that was a really big deal when Kobe passed Jordan. Like LeBron could potentially still be the best player in the world when he passes Jordan. Like he could be the number one guy in the entire sport passing Jordan on the all-time list with another 5 years left after that to just rack up more points easily, you know? And, that's the kind of thing, even when this conversation really first started going like 3-4 years ago, that I, you know, mathematically, I knew that was possible. Like if you just do the charts out and you say, okay, if he adds this many points per game for the next 3 years, this is where he's going to be. Like theoretically, you knew it was possible. But now that we're witnessing it sort of like accomplishment by accomplishment, step by step, it's pretty nuts.
Yeah. I mean, it's insane. And, you know, speaking of nuts, you know, I do have to talk about my favorite gelato place where they have the best pistachio gelato out there.
Oh, that was seamless.
It was perfect. It was perfect. I was hoping you were going to give me some sort of intro into it. And I'm talking about Uli's Gelateria in downtown LA. It's in the Spring Arcade on 5th, in between 5th and 6th Street. You can't go wrong. They got the pistachio gelato, my favorite speculoos cookies. They have basil, olive oil, banana. They got it all. And anything you want, you know, they got the best service. They have the best people running the place. You can't go wrong. If you're in downtown LA, I highly recommend you check it out. Uli's Gelateria in the Spring Arcade on Spring Street in between 5th and 6th Street.
Well, he's nuts. He's cool, just like gelato. LeBron James.
There you go.
Yeah. So I'm looking at the all-time assist leaders right now. LeBron's got a real good shot at third. Getting up to second, he's going to have to pass Jason Kidd. You know, that could be a little too much work. It's not impossible. But I think the best way to put this is he's going to be a top three scorer and a top three assist guy, basically no matter what, as long as he hangs on here for like, you know, four more seasons.
I mean, that's really impressive. I mean, how many guys that are in the all-time scoring list in the top five are also going to be in the top five in assist? Even yeah, if you, and, I mean, that's still like a, that's all like an all-around guy even. So
yeah, he's like Stockton and Malone in one.
Yeah, exactly. So we kind of touched on it a little bit in our earlier question, you know, kind of flashing forward to next season. You know, are we destined for this matchup of Warriors, Cavs, assuming everybody's healthy, let's take the injury risk out of it, because it's really easy to say if all so-and-so is injured, they're not going to make it. But Warriors, Cavs, is this something we're going to see next year in the finals as well, and possibly even the year after?
If I had to bet on it for next year, I would. My favorite theoretical question that I've been posing to people, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, is like, pick your favorite team that's not the Cavaliers and the Warriors. Give them their realistic best case summer for like what could make them as good as possible in the short term. And then how do they stack up against Warriors or Cavaliers? So like, for example, if you're Boston, your best case summer is you draft Markel Fultz, you just sign Gordon Hayward outright, and then you trade your future assets, maybe next year's Nets pick, and you get Paul George, right? Would you rather have that team or the Cavaliers? You know, does that team have a real answer for LeBron? Will they have a better answer for LeBron? But I still think I would take Cleveland's roster, you know, 1-9. You go in the West, you kind of play the same game with the Spurs, like give them Chris Paul, give them Patty Mills back on a discount, give them Jonathan Simmons back on a discount, maybe even trade LaMarcus Aldridge for some pieces that work a little bit better, maybe add one more player as a free agent, you know, just really get nuts with like the roster retooling, give them Kawhi Leonard healthy. Like, would you rather have that team or a Warriors team where Steph, KD, Draymond, Clay are all in their prime, clicking on all cylinders with another year together of chemistry and cohesion, and most likely, you know, they'll be able to get Iguodala back. I mean, it gets a little bit tricky in terms of keeping him, but
right.
I feel like he's highly motivated to stay around. I mean, he seems to love it there, so that is sort of Golden State's one big question mark. I mean, I guess my problem is I've been running these dream scenarios with these second-tier teams, and I have yet to really conceive of a super team that I feel like can really challenge Cleveland and Golden State. And even though that's boring and that's like not the answer people want to hear, because they want action, they want really good conference finals matchups, they don't want it to feel inevitable, and it's really boring that you only get to see these two teams play twice every regular season, I have yet to see a path around it.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting hypothetical. I think the team I'm going to pick is probably going to annoy you, just because I listened enough to the Open Floor podcast to know that your theories on not your dislike, but just your with Philly, how you're like they got to be healthy for a while before you start buying into it. But I think with a healthy Embiid, you know, a healthy Simmons. I mean, we're not quite sure what they have in Simmons. I'm a big fan of Dario Saric. Like, they're a deep team. Add in the three pick is, gosh, let's assume they take, I don't even know, who would be the third pick for them if you're Philly? Who would there be?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It's because it kind of comes down to, do you draft around Simmons or not? Like, do you take a point guard kind of as a hedge against him being your point guard? Personally, I wouldn't. I would probably just add, you know, Tatum or Jackson as another wing and just continue to trust Simmons as the point guard. But I think Philly could go in a lot of different directions. And a lot of people have been saying, like, somehow if Lonzo slips out of two, then they would go Lonzo. And that's a really weird, like, kind of cross-positional, cross-skills matchup with him and Simmons. So, I don't know. I mean, whoever you give them, though, I think my thing with Philly is, like, they could have that ceiling to, like, really be that super team. But it's not going to happen next year. I mean, even if Embiid's fully healthy, even if, like, Simmons is rookie of the year and Embiid is an MVP candidate, they're still not on Cleveland's level. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, you're definitely, I think you add a few more pieces. I think, you know, they find a way to get Patty Mills and, you know, get more shooting just altogether. You know, they find a, they give JJ Redick the 18 to 20 million he's looking for. I think, you know, and add kind of like, cause that's their biggest thing, is they're going to need shooting with Simmons on the court. Obviously we don't know how, if his shots improve much or not, but they're going to need somebody to continue to help stretch that floor for them. I think that's kind of the hope I have, you know, in that sense. Milwaukee's another team that I think hopefully can come out of nowhere. I don't know what's going to happen with Jabari Parker. You know, maybe you bring him off the bench as your sixth man, but they're still going to have to, they're another team that needs to add shooting and that kind of stuff. But I think it's just when you look at it, you know, as you say, as you've been doing with your hypothetical stuff, I just don't see how we don't get this matchup next year.
Yeah, I mean, the East is tricky because, I mean, nobody's going to have a better number one than LeBron. Are any of these teams going to have a better number two than Kyrie? Are any of these teams going to have a better number three than Kevin Love? I mean, maybe, but I doubt it. And, you know, past that, they also have Tristan Thompson, who I think is pretty much the ideal center in that context. I mean, I think he's like an all-star in his role, or whatever that phrase that, you know, TV commentators love to use. I mean, he's that valuable. And when you look at their top competition in the East, you'd rather have Tristan Thompson than any of Toronto's centers, including Ibaka. You'd rather have him than any of Boston's bigs, including Horford. Horford's, you know, more pure talent, pure skill. But in terms of fit, I'd rather have Thompson. Same thing goes with all of Milwaukee's bigs. And I honestly think Milwaukee is like most interesting when they play Giannis as their center.
Right.
Or, you know, you're waiting for Thon, basically. So you just go right down the list of those second tier guys, like basically position by position, Cleveland's got them. And that's why we saw, you know, a 12-1 run through the Eastern Conference. And outside of Boston, I don't see any of these teams really in position to make an immediate short term leap. In terms of the Western Conference, I mean, the Clippers are at risk of complete explosion.
I've given up on them. The Clippers have, I mean, even if they brought everybody back, there's something about whenever the Warriors see these guys. And, you know, granted, it stems back to the Clippers knocking them out of the playoffs a few years ago in a game seven. The Clippers don't get an off game from the Warriors. Like, the Warriors are ramped up no matter how bad the Clippers are doing at that point. The Warriors come in ready to kick that team's ass every time they see them.
Yeah, it's like a mortician and a dead body. I mean, the Warriors are sizing them up with scalpels, like ready to just, you know, completely dissect every part of them. Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that brings us back to the same three teams as this year, really. I mean, I think the Spurs are the next best team. I hate writing them off in this conversation because they look so good in the first half of game one. And Kawhi is that good of a player where if he's healthy for the series is just a completely different series. It doesn't mean San Antonio is going to win, but the whole series plays out. I mean, certainly there's going to be more wrinkles. They're not going to blow game one. There's no way they lose that game if Kawhi is healthy. And then back at home, San Antonio's confidence sky high for game three. That series is going six, I would think, if Kawhi is healthy.
No, absolutely.
So they're not that far away. But the tricky part for them is just like they're in this weird kind of, not purgatory, but they're just kind of in this transition where it's like, who do they want to be? You know, Manu, Pau, Tony Parker, like they all kind of work there. They work well enough to get you 60 wins, but do they work to beat Golden State? I think those are kind of open question guys on all of them. And you can even throw LaMarcus in that mix too. I mean, I think LaMarcus can play better than he showed in games 2, 3, and 4 of that series. But especially if Kawhi is healthy, I mean, he's just kind of in a more natural role there. But again, it kind of goes back to what I was saying about Tristan Thompson versus all the bigs in the East. It's like, would you rather have LaMarcus Aldridge or Draymond Green? I'm taking Draymond Green 10 times out of 10. I mean, it's not even close in that matchup, you know? And it's kind of the same thing. Is there any, you know, number one guy who you'd rather have than KD or Steph? No. Is there any number two guy anywhere you'd rather have
than KD or Steph?
Exactly. Number three with Draymond. I mean, I think Draymond's the best third option in the league by far. And then, you know, you go right down the list to Klay Thompson and from there too. So, their talent has been unbelievable. And I think one thing that gets lost, and I was thinking about this last night, in terms of how Cleveland and Golden State kind of built their cores, it's crazy. Like LeBron was the number one pick who left and then came back. Kyrie was the number one overall pick because they were terrible for, you know, a stretch to kind of get him and really bad when they first had him. Love was a guy they traded, you know, in a blockbuster deal with multiple number one picks to get him. Tristan Thompson was a lottery pick who they, you know, it was kind of like this big debate, like, do they take him or Jonas at the time? And, you know, that looked terrible for the first couple of years, and now it's looked brilliant. They have all these other roster pieces. They kind of just fleeced the Knicks in trades. And you go to the Golden State side, it's like you nail two kind of late or mid-lottery picks in Curry and Thompson. You pull the biggest free agent signing of the last 15 years besides LeBron in Kevin Durant. You nail a second round pick to get Draymond. I mean, the way these teams came together, so many things had to go right. And so we do kind of assume that, oh, these teams are just these unbelievable super teams. And I think I saw Steph was kind of saying that was disrespectful to their work ethic and their effort level this year in terms of how well they played to kind of make it to the finals, that people were being disrespectful by just assuming that they would get there. I think the true disrespect is us just assuming that these teams would have come together like this. You know what I mean? Like the amount of intricacy that went into actually constructing these rosters is phenomenal. And so full credit to their front offices on both sides. I think they don't get enough credit because this was not just like, you know, like the Thunder, where it's just like you nail Durant, you nail Westbrook, you nail Harden, and all of a sudden you've got a super team, right? Like that's just like three awesome draft picks and you're gone. This was a much more varied and, you know, just like delicate roster building on both sides.
Yeah, and luck plays into it a little bit, especially in like the Warriors' part for Draymond Green. Like he wasn't playing until David Lee got hurt. You know what I mean? And then they stumble onto this, and they're like, you know, Kerr's like, holy shit, you know, this is how it's got to be from now on. And then David Lee was on his way out from that point. And I think you're right. Both front offices have done a phenomenal job, you know, finding the right pieces. I mean, freaking the Cavs got Kyle Korver for nothing. I mean, Mike Dunleavy, and I don't even know what else they gave up, if anything else, really. A pick went to Portland, I think. But it's, I mean, the work that these front offices do to bring in these pieces is phenomenal. And I think we just don't have a – there's just no team that's going to really match that. Like, if the Spurs add Chris Paul to their roster, I'm still picking the Warriors in that series. I mean, would you have it different? Like, say they had just
– No, I would take the Warriors. I mean, you know, you can kind of put Chris Paul on any team. I'm not sure. You'd still take Steph over him. You know what I mean? And, yeah, in terms of, you know, where these teams are kind of going forward and just the gaps that they have around them, you know, one thing – that the Korver trade reinforces, and you could even say this with the JaVale McGee move or the David West addition, is that forever, even before this current super team era, before the LeBron super team era for the Heatles, when they were bringing in like Chris Anderson, Birdman, forever in the NBA, vets have wanted to climb aboard championship contenders. You know, whether it's midseason, whether it's you know, front offices doing their players a solid by trading them, sort of like the Korver move, whether it's guys leaving money on the table to go play for better teams. The rich have always been able to get richer in the NBA, at least as long as I've been covering it, and surely further beyond than that. So even if we fast forward to next year's trade deadline and the Spurs nail it, they get Chris Paul, they're awesome, they're on like a 65 win pace, the Celtics have their dream summer, you know, they're on a 60 plus win pace, and Golden State and Cleveland are still there and everybody's healthy. If you're that veteran free agent, if you're that designated shooter like a Kyle Korver, if you're that David West or whoever it might be, or you're Larry Sanders, you know, it didn't quite work out for Cleveland, but they were kind of thinking that route in terms of adding a center, right? All those guys are going to still pick Cleveland or Golden State over any of these other teams, right? Like, if you had to bank on who's going to give you the best chance to win a title and you're taking minimum money or taking very little money, you're still going to choose those teams just because you've seen them do it these last 3 years, right? So there are these other factors in terms of how players move in the NBA that tend to reinforce the top-heavy nature of it. And I don't think you can legislate that out. And I think that's got to be really frustrating for teams like the Celtics, where, you know, they kind of sit out the deadline and they have their reasons for doing it, but then they have to sit and watch as Cleveland adds a Kyle Korver who can be a complete difference maker, and they don't, like you said, they basically pay nothing for it. And same thing for, you know, some of these teams, like for example, the Clippers. You know, they're struggling with their bench for years, right? They're cycling all these pieces. They kind of think they hit a home run at the beginning of last season when they had great minutes from Moe Spates. You know, Crawford was playing pretty well for them early. Austin Rivers was playing pretty well for them early. And they just fully felt like they finally had a bench unit for the first time in a while, right? Well, you contrast that with Golden State just plucking JaVale McGee for basically nothing on a non-guaranteed contract, and now he's able to start in playoff games and look like a real contributor and like give serious problems to opposing defenses as like a number five option in those lineups. And it's like, that doesn't seem fair. I mean, you could spend years searching for players who aren't going to make as big of an impact as JaVale McGee made in the playoffs.
Right.
And this was a guy who everybody thought was out of the league for 3 years, right? So I don't know. I can understand why a lot of these second tier or third tier teams have sort of started to like leak out that their plan is to sort of wait these guys out, because it's got to be incredibly frustrating to try to compete for some of these players when you know you're bringing a knife to a gunfight.
Yeah, I think you've killed it right there. I think that's the whole argument. It's just there is no real reason. Like, that's why I think teams like Philly and Milwaukee are kind of set up, and even the Lakers to a small, lesser degree, but set up with just build your young guys to take over as soon as these guys are on their downward trend. And that's still going to be 2 or 3 years away, I think. So that's still quite the challenge there. Looking a little further ahead past the finals, though, what are you hoping? What draft day move or offseason signing or trade are you hoping for or, you know, hoping realistically that can happen, you know, that we both kind of decided that it's not really going to upset the balance, but would make things a little more interesting in the East or the West?
To be honest, the number one thing I want to see is I want Blake Griffin to make a real move here. You know, I want him to find a better home, because I've talked to him a few occasions in sort of like one-on-one settings, interviews. The guy is really funny. He's really nice. He's just got a great joy about life. And you can watch some of his stand up and see like his sense of humor. I mean, he's funny on Twitter. I'm not professing to know him personally at all. That's not what I'm saying. I see one guy off the court and I see a completely different person on the court. And to me, that says a lot about the team context that's around him on the court. Yes, he's a competitive player. Yes, that's going to come out when he plays on the court. Of course, he's going to be more serious there. He's going to try to use his physical strength to kind of bully people. And yes, he's got a little bit of that, you know, whininess to him in terms of like confronting the referees, right? But I think, and maybe it's just because I've gotten kind of wrapped up in this idea of joy from the Warriors, where everybody looks like they're loving life all the time with Golden State, you know, minus when they're blowing the 3-1 lead. And we can kind of scratch that part out of the history. But like, for the balance of the last 3 years, Golden State's loved life more than basically any team we've ever seen. And kind of Kevin Arnovitz had a great piece contrasting Warriors culture with Spurs culture, where, you know, Spurs, it's about discipline. Warriors, it's really about joy. I don't think, you know, you can't put Blake on the Warriors. That doesn't work. We can get Blake into a scenario where he's having a lot of fun. If he's like back to sort of feeling comfortable. And I honestly don't know exactly where that would be. But I would just like to see him be more of who he is. And I think that that would, you know, potentially reveal or unveil more to his game than maybe people think he's still got left, because a lot of people are ready to write him off. You know, his best year statistically 2 or 3 years ago, he's had a lot of injury issues. Things haven't gone his way. He just kind of seems to me like he's a fresh start candidate. So it's not that I want to place him on any specific team necessarily. I just want him to think long and hard about like, okay, the Clippers can offer you the most money. You know, they can give you that 5-year deal. You know what you're getting with them. You know the coach. You know the core players that are around you. Is there something else better out there? And that's kind of what I'd like to see. You know, I'd like to potentially see what a change of scenery could do for a guy like Blake Griffin.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I kind of think maybe not as large a market would kind of help him out a bit. Like, I wouldn't want to see him in New York with the media there and ready to scrutinize everything he does, you know, and kind of thing. I think maybe like a second tier sort of market might be a good spot for him in that sense, to really kind of find that joy that you're talking about. For me, I'm still sticking with the Clippers, but I would like to see CP find a place where he can finally at least get to the conference finals. I'm tired of the whole debate of, you know, he's not good because he's never gotten out of the second round. I kind of just want to shut those guys up. I'm a huge Chris Paul fan, and you know what he's done on the court, and I think everybody using that as he's not successful kind of really bothers me. So kind of the same idea as yours. Just I really want him to think about it. I know he's going to be giving up a shit ton of money, but I kind of want him to think legacy wise you know, where would be the great spot for him, I think, you know, and start to make those moves. You know, I necessarily don't think the Spurs have we'll find a way to get him there. I just think with the cap situation and everything, I think one place I find interesting for him, I'm not sure if this would get him into the conference finals, but would be a fun ride, is I think Denver would be really a fun place, reuniting him with, you know, Coach Malone, who he was with in New Orleans when Malone was an assistant, I think would be kind of rejuvenating him a bit. And I think he would add a very interesting dynamic to that Denver team, and adding him with Jokic and all that fun stuff. So that's kind of the one guy I'm hoping for, and seeing what will happen in the offseason, just hoping that he can kind of like pick the selection based on his legacy more than just his bank.
Yeah, and I think the tricky part with reading these Spurs rumors is that we know Chris is very comfortable in LA with his family. He's a very family-oriented guy. So that means if he moves teams, the whole family's got to move, right? So that's a big decision for him. And then, like you're saying, in terms of, you know, the 5-year max that he can get and the, you know, the 38 age rule that he changed and all of that, he's set himself up to make an obscene amount of money and still be the guy in LA, you know, desirable place. A lot of people like to live, right? So there is a lot working against Chris moving. And, you know, I guess my question is, you know, he is this competitive guy. He is someone that we know he almost wants to win too much, right? Does that become the priority over maintaining a happy life? Because this guy seems very happy. And I was there when they got eliminated this season in the playoffs. And I'm not sure they were completely blown away that it happened in the first round, especially after when Blake went down. Chris put in a valiant effort. I thought he was strong throughout the series. Didn't have his best game in game seven. But, you know, he kind of did his thing. I didn't get the sense that that loss shattered him. Like, it was the kind of thing that, like, he had to change his whole life to avoid. And I don't know if that means that he's gotten used to it. I don't know if that means he's just so balanced in his life that it's not just championship or bust. And, you know, that's something that we heard Kevin Durant talk about recently in terms of, you know, there's more to life than just being a champion. Don't only judge me on the rings. And every person's got to prioritize those things differently. If Chris's priority is let's just have a shot, let's be a playoff team, let's be good, and let's have everything off the court, you know, be status quo, and let's cash in the most money possible, it's really hard to hate on that decision if that's the direction he chooses. But that could mean that he does wind up being susceptible to this kind of criticism you're talking about hating, which is, oh, he never makes the conference finals. And he will be a fascinating decision this summer. You know, if he moves, it will change every kind of every narrative about him. You know, it will become the only thing he cares about winning is if he goes somewhere else, right? Whereas if he stays, it's everything that I've just mentioned.
Yeah, and I never fault guys for any decision they make. You know, I always say, listen, make as much money as you possibly can. You know, the running joke with my friends of like, you know, well, you don't want to do that because you'd be a sellout. I was like, I want to be in an opportunity where I get to be a sellout, you know, and that's kind of the same thing with CP. And you got to make, you know, every opportunity he can. I wouldn't fault him if he stays in LA. I think that's the most likely scenario anyways. I am concerned with that kind of stuff. Ben, I've taken up a ton of your time on this holiday weekend. I really appreciate it. Why don't we wrap it up here? Tell the people where they can find you, what you got coming next, what to look for, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, si.com/NBA. That's kind of the homepage for all of our NBA coverage. You know, we're throwing the kitchen sink at the finals. So Lee Jenkins, Chris Ballard, myself, Andrew Sharp, Rob Mahoney, you can read all this stuff there. Check out the Open Floor podcast. That's on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. Open Floor SI NBA podcast. I'm on Twitter at Ben Golliver, BenGolliver. I think that should do it for the shout outs.
Perfect. You did great, Ben. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this episode. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and have yourselves a great week.